some people don't ever want to grow up, including Peter Pan and music teacher Susan Johnson's sixth graders at Fort Wainwright Elementary School. Here's the song they wrote to stave off the aging process. Why a song about growing up?
Well, because we just thought maybe it'd be a nice thing to make up for our school.
It could have been about anything, though. How come growing up?
Because, you know, we're sixth and fifth graders just starting to grow up, you know, and starting to go in, pretty soon we'd be going into seventh grade and everything, you know, and we'd be growing up.
You want to grow up?
Yes.
Are you worried about growing up?
No.
Why are you talking about armadillo?
I don't know.
You want to grow up?
Yes.
You want to grow up?
Yes.
Anybody here not want to grow up? Lots of hands. Okay, let me talk to somebody who doesn't want to grow up. I see one right here in the front row. How come you don't want to grow up?
I'm short as it is.
How about somebody else? Who else doesn't want to grow up? How come?
Because then I don't get to do as many things. Yeah.
You think that's really true?
Yeah. I don't want to grow up because I like being a kid and she wants to get old.
Have you ever seen an armadillo?
No.
Have you ever seen a crocodile? How do you know they're such bad animals?
And I used to live in Georgia. There's lots of alligators there, and I've seen a couple close up. And I used to catch snakes a lot. And once, accidentally, I caught a rattler, and they're pretty mean.
You're still alive to tell the tale.
Yeah, but geez, I was lucky then.
Teacher, what do you have to say about growing up?
Well, we picked this subject because it's animals is something that everybody likes. And we tried to pick fairly dangerous ones, or they did. They picked the rather dangerous ones. And supposedly, any of these animals could do us in if we did some of the things we sang about.
How do you feel warning kids about growing up when you're grown up yourself?
Oh, well, no. I rather agree with them. I think they have a pretty good time.
Just like the Fort Wainwright sixth graders, I don't want to grow up either. Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
You've heard about the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon. Now you can add the Artemisia luteca, the Aragonum flavin, and the Oxytropis cobacensis. They're three of the eight plants proposed for endangered status by Dave Murray, professor of botany at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. He's just published a field manual entitled Threatened and Endangered Plants of Alaska. The Endangered Species Act of 1973, amended in 1978, provides protection for both animal and plant species with a very limited distribution and that are threatened with extinction through potential human activities.
Much of the information that the public has received about the Endangered Species Act relates to animals. Plants?
Yeah, plants were actually in the original bill. But we knew so little of what ones to protect that the Smithsonian Institution was asked to come up with a list for the nation. And about 1975, they presented to Congress a substantial list of plants, and quite a large number for Alaska, large enough that I found it quite surprising. And the more we went through that list, the more we saw we could winnow it down to some extent, and that's what this present work has done. It's divided that first listing by Smithsonian Institution into those that we feel probably are justifiably endangered, those that are threatened, and then the rest of those proposed by Smithsonian are taxa, that is, species with an undetermined status. We don't know anything about them, or at least not enough to put them on a formal listing.
And what's the difference between threatened, endangered, and rare?
They're all rare. But of the rare species, some are known from only one location in Alaska, or two locations in Alaska. And because they are very localized, they are therefore more likely to be eradicated forevermore. And so they are given endangered status. Those threatened occur at more localities, maybe more widespread, but are still very, very restricted and could become endangered if their habitats are modified. And so you could certainly debate whether one should be threatened or endangered. There is no quantitative way of assessing and determining the status as one or the other.
Given the size of the state, which is something that you point out in your introduction, isn't it rather difficult to determine just how rare or how limited is the distribution
Absolutely.
Of the plant?
Absolutely. We're always faced with that in Alaska more than any other area, is that we simply do not know what might be somewhere else that we haven't looked. We've been spending years on inventory, and it's still incomplete, because any summer I go out, and my work of the last few years has been largely in the Brooks Range and Arctic Slope, I can find plants where we didn't know they were. So I extend the known distribution of these, and since I can do that for a large number of taxa, I have to presume that our information is pretty imperfect. Nevertheless, for some of these, at least the ones who I have said on this first listing ought to be considered endangered, we've given a pretty good shot at trying to find them in other places, and we've failed.
It is possible, according to Murray, that some of the plants listed as endangered are not really endangered at all. They may exist, perhaps in quantity, in other circumpolar regions. One of the difficulties in correlating international data is the use of different names for what may be the same plant. This is especially critical given the Bering Land Bridge that formerly connected what we now refer to as Alaska and Siberia. Murray says that our flora is very strongly Asian, and he's been exchanging plant specimens with Soviet botanists to obtain samples of Siberian flora. Through these exchanges, it may develop that some plants now considered in imminent danger of extinction aren't. And that could make some developers sleep better at night.
Is it possible that if a plant were found, say, at the site of a new drilling site in the Beaufort, that that would halt development?
It could likely cause that particular well to be recited. They might say, well, where else would be almost as good to place that well? The last three summers, I've been under contract to look at the well sites for the drilling in NPRA, in the National Petroleum Reserve. And we have gone to each one of the drill sites. We've looked at the sites for the material that will be used to make the pads. We looked at the roads and the proposed airstrips. So that there has been a process of clearance. In fact, I think that's required before BLM will give permission for Husky Oil to go ahead and drill. So far, we've had no difficulty, and I think with the amendments of 1978, which allow some discretion in administering the act, it seems unlikely that we're really going to come up against a firm, irrevocable cancellation on the basis of plant species.
But there is, in effect, some conflict between protecting the plants and potential development.
Sure. Sure, that's quite possible. Just as they have had to negotiate well sites, the alignment of the pipeline with respect to the Peregrine Falcon. That same sort of negotiation may come up in the future with respect to plants.
And then there's the question, so what about the plants? Who really cares if this particular willow or fern or whatever is no longer with us? How many people would know? How many people would care? Is it really going to affect our lives?
It might not affect our lives, that one willow, the one poppy. But if we take the aggregate, if we have no restraint on extirpations, and we look at the aggregate extirpations that could take place, maybe then we have set ourselves up for something where there would be a loss. I think we're taking a lot of this on the principle that genetic diversity is good, and not to consider ways of preserving items that are endangered is simply arrogance of man.
David Murray, author of a field manual on threatened and endangered plants of Alaska. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.
In a country far removed from either the North or South Poles, there exists a world-renowned facility for polar studies, the Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge, England. Terence Armstrong in Fairbanks recently to deliver the university's commencement address is the assistant director of the 60-year-old institute.
It was founded in 1920 by a member of Captain Scott's final Antarctic expedition, who came back to Cambridge after the expedition, and along with another member, set the place up. It was part of the University of Cambridge, and still is, but has gradually grown down the years, so that it now actually employs some staff. For the first 20 years of its existence, all staff were voluntary. Now I'm happy to say there are some paid members, and I'm one of those.
So it's actually kind of an accident of history or philanthropy that there's a Polar Research Institute in a place that is not near the poles.
Yes, you have it exactly right. Why it should have been at Cambridge? I think it was because of this man on the expedition who came back to Cambridge. He became first professor of geography there. And the other man on the expedition who was associated with our founding happened to be a university administrator in Cambridge. So these two had a Cambridge connection, and for that reason they got the place to Cambridge. You're right in supposing we have no direct link with the polar regions. The country as a whole has no Arctic territory of any kind, though there is a claim to Antarctic territory, which, however, is now subject to the Antarctic Treaty of 1960, and the claim is not pressed. It exists, but is frozen. So that is the only actual link between Britain and the polar regions, so that our study at the Scott Polar Research Institute can be described as properly academic. We can stand back from the pressures of government administration and all that sort of thing and survey the scene and obviously reach conclusions which are that much more objective, truthful, and interesting than anyone else can.
Interesting to other academics.
Yes, interesting, of course, to other academics. We don't presume to produce solutions which will affect the course of events in Alaska or Arctic Canada or anything like that.
If the work of the academics at Scott Polar had no practical impacts, I wondered, why bother at all?
It's obviously fundamental to progress in the world.
Scientists are working on that progress in several areas.
There are two research groups working on primarily physical problems. One is the measurement of the thickness of land ice, particularly in the Antarctic, but also in the Arctic, how big that large glacier is that overlies the whole of the Antarctic continent. The other is concerned with the drift of sea ice on water surfaces in primarily the Arctic, because this is an impediment to shipping, and it's useful to know how sea ice behaves. Then there is the sort of work that I do myself, which is more concerned with human affairs, particularly with economic development of northern areas, with special reference in my own case to Siberia.
Scholars from Australia, New Zealand, the Soviet Union, Scandinavia, United States, and Canada frequently visit the Institute to conduct research in the extensive library and to conduct scientific research.
I think that one of the strong points of being in a country which has no direct polar connection is that other people can come to one's base and study. It is, after all, a good place for instance, Americans and Russians to meet. It is, in a sense, neutral ground. It may not be seen as altogether neutral by everybody, but at least it's free from some of the pressures.
The Scott Polar Research Institute also has a small number of students in a postgraduate multidisciplinary polar studies program.
We hope that we will thus provide a small pool of people who have certain knowledge and skills which are actually hard to acquire elsewhere.
I asked Armstrong if he thought it strange that countries with a vested polar interest don't have similar programs.
Yes, I'm rather surprised that they don't, I must say. I would have thought there would have been a number of programs of this kind in North America, and I think probably quite soon there will be, but it is a rather curious thing that it has been a non-polar country which has, as it were, set the ball rolling.
Perhaps it's time for other institutions, such as the University of Alaska, to pick up that ball. You've been listening to Terence Armstrong, Assistant Director of the Scott Polar Research Institute in Cambridge, England. I'm Karen McPherson in Fairbanks.